I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice. Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, it's great to see you guys on what is going to be the last Monday of June, which feels a little bit too soon, by the way, doesn't it? The last Monday of June, and then we're going to head right into the July 4th holiday. We have a really big week of news ahead of us. We never know what to predict completely. Forecasting is like that. We see it with the weather. We have an idea of what's to come, but then there's all sorts of things that happen that we don't expect. So we approach this week with some humility, knowing that we're not going to know everything that's going to take place. However, the calendar is very helpful for us this week because we do know of certain large events, and we also know that we receive some information that is going to be part of the continued story this week. So we have brand new numbers on the U.S. southern and northern border that we're going to talk about. We have an expectation that we are going to get Supreme Court decisions this week, including one on the presidency that could have wide sweeping impact on the American presidency for years to come. And we also have our first scheduled presidential debate. Yes, it's already here. CNN is going to be hosting this on Thursday. And there's a big change from historic precedent that really matters for your experience. And this idea of a shared collective experience that the American public has with these debates. So it's a marked change. We're going to talk about what it means for you. And also what it means for us together. This idea of shared experience is something I've been thinking about since I read an article this morning that actually has to do with Ryan Seacrest. Don't worry, I'm going to pull these things together, I promise you. But this idea of shared experience with the American public, what are we actually sharing in collectively together at one time, rather than a lot of different experiences we're getting from the media at different points, because we're able to sort of create our own channels and consume our own experiences and control that, rather than turning, let's say, to a television set that is only going to have a limited number of options. So this is something I've been thinking a lot about, shared experience. And there's a part of this shared experience in all these stories. We all have a shared experience with the U.S. borders, even if we don't live in a southern or northern state. The U.S. borders impact the United States of America. Border is how a country defines itself. It has to do with our national security, our shared economy, you know, what we stand for, our national identity. This idea of the Supreme Court is a shared experience. What the Supreme Court rules on and how that ruling applies to our lives can impact all of us for multiple generations. And then we have the presidential debates and the experience that we're able to observe something at the same time together, like the Super Bowl, but different. And so all of these stories have that shared experience in them. I was a little bit worried jumping on live today. We talk about Smarter News being real news for real people. I love that idea. I love that we don't have the barriers that we typically do on a regular news broadcast. There are some positives and negatives to that. Absolutely. One of them is I'm kind of in an office complex, and about 45 minutes ago, all of the landscapers showed up, you know, with the blowers and the mowers and and I thought, how am I going to figure this one out? You know, do I go outside and tell them to tune into Smarter News, but I'm going to need a little quiet out here? I mean, you can't really do that. But I also thought there was an interesting metaphor, perhaps. Have any of you ever used one of those blowers, you know, to clean off your porch or the garage in our case? And I never had one until I actually lived in a house, which only just happened recently. I always lived in apartments. So didn't use one of those. It's very gratifying. It's very gratifying to blow off leaves, move dust away. But there is a question about effectiveness, right? Where does all of it, you don't suck it up. It's not like a vacuum. It just kind of blows back in. And that sort of feels like the news today, doesn't it? We kind of capture something. We're like, okay, I think we got our hands on something. And then something else develops that makes us feel like we don't have it in control. So today, what we're going to try to do is provide kind of like a clean patio for you. We're going to kind of blow out the clutter. And we're going to feel good about the news, even just for a moment. We're going to feel good about the news for the week ahead. And then I can't guarantee what's going to happen after that. But my hope is for only the best. Okay, let's start off quick with a couple conversation starters. These are just fun stories. I think they get us warmed up for some of the tougher stuff. So here's one for you. Let me go ahead and show it to you. This is a great picture from the Associated Press. The title from the outhouse: 400 meter runner goes from locked in a porta potty straight to the Olympics. No, this is a real story. Let me go ahead and read this to you. It was a classic case of going from the outhouse to the penthouse. Less than an hour before her semifinal at U.S. track trials, 400-meter runner Kendall Ellis was trapped in a porta potty, banging on the door, screaming for someone to let her out. Thankfully, somebody did. She won that race in a personal best time. Of course, she had a lot of anxiety. I mean, come on. Maybe there's something to it. Then came back Sunday to top that mark and win the final along with the national championship and the spot in the Olympics that comes with it. Quote, crazy things happen right before something great is about to occur. So maybe I needed that to get all the nerves and adrenaline out, she said. What a great way to look at it. Just a reminder that the Olympic trials are continuing this week. We had swimming, of course, over the last several days. We have track and field, and we're going to get the gymnasts this weekend too. So it's a lot of prep as we're about a month out from the Olympic Games. So that's exciting. Has anyone ever gotten locked in the bathroom? Has that happened to anybody? True story, when I was recently traveling overseas, I was having dinner with my husband and I went to the restroom and I was like, I don't need to bring my phone. The phone comes with me everywhere. It does come with me to the restroom sometimes. I mean, let's just be honest. You know, it's like you got your purse, your phone, all this stuff. And I didn't bring it that time, but I was in a really old bathroom and it was kind of like down a set of stairs. Couldn't get out for a while. I made it. That's why I'm here now, but couldn't get out. So I related to this. This felt like a very personal story. And so there you go. Let's go ahead on to the next one. Be careful out there. You never know. Is that the takeaway? You never know. Speaking of never knowing, here's something that could be something that could impact us. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Do Americans drink too much? Alcohol is driving a debate in Washington. Agencies, lobbyists, and lawmakers are fighting over alcohol guidelines due to be updated next year. Okay, so you have a couple more months. We're almost to the midway point of 2024. I think it's this weekend, to be exact. And I know that's also a little bit scary. So you have a New Year's resolution that didn't get done. You still have a little bit of time, but this is looking to 2025. And the Wall Street Journal, which always has fun with some of these stories, writes this: a fight is brewing in Washington, D.C. over booze. For nearly three decades, federal dietary guidelines have said it is safe for men to have two or fewer drinks a day and for women to have one. That could change next year when the Agriculture and Health and Human Services Departments update recommendations that are part of federal dietary guidelines. It goes on to say the guidance on alcohol consumption is being considered separately from the dietary guidelines. And this is happening for the very first time. So it's notable in that we're going to take a look at alcohol completely separate than, let's say, a food pyramid. So how does it actually fit in? And as you know, there's been a lot of discussion and new research about alcohol and a drop off in younger people drinking. For the first time in America, we're seeing more cannabis use than alcohol use. Sort of an interesting fact there too. Did you know there's something called the Bourbon Caucus in Congress? This is true. This is our taxpayer money at work, the Bourbon Caucus, a bipartisan, thankfully, group of lawmakers. The group was founded in 2009 by a lawmaker from Kentucky, which considers itself the birthplace of bourbon and now has around 40 members. Those are the people we want to hang out with, right? In Washington, D.C. What do they get done after a few drinks? That's what we want to know. What's curious about this is that there's recommendations coming from two different places. So there's a panel of health experts that Health and Human Services has put together. This is from my understanding. And then also an expert panel from Congress. And so they're getting, you know, lobbyists are all over the place there trying to tell people how to think about alcohol. So prepare yourself. You have another 6 months, but come the new year, we may have a different sort of guidance on alcohol and what's appropriate. Whether or not the government is the place to receive that guidance, kind of an interesting question. We've asked that question a lot over the last couple of years, haven't we, about health guidance from the government. Who's the best source of information? But it will be notable regardless in the news when the government does issue this. So that's something I thought would be interesting for you to know about. And then here's the opinion piece on Ryan Seacrest. And this is about Ryan Seacrest, but also not really about Ryan Seacrest. Let me go ahead and pull this up just so you can see. This is actually from the Washington Post. It was an interesting piece for a couple of different reasons. Let me explain. The title is Ryan Seacrest our last chance to save a shared national culture? Is Ryan Seacrest our last chance to save a shared national culture? After Wheel of Fortune host Pat Sajak, it's Seacrest to the rescue again. And they go through the list of different roles that Ryan Seacrest has taken over the last several years, from Casey Kasem's role as DJ on American Top 40, Dick Clark for New Year's Eve. He followed LA's legendary radio morning DJ, Rick Dees. He also replaced Regis Philbin at a different point. And now he's replacing Pat Sajak after Pat Sajak was the host of Wheel of Fortune for more than four decades. And so here's the crux of this article, which I thought really pulled out once you got past the Ryan Seacrest part, which the author is saying he's relatively inoffensive. He's relatively young at 49. He says he has no real talent, but the reality is he's had a myriad of really interesting gigs that have resonated with American culture. And the stat that really stood out to me here is that one time 40 million Americans were watching Wheel of Fortune every night. So there was a shared experience there. Now it's around 9 million, still a big number, but not 40 million. And what Mark Fisher, the writer of this piece, is saying is that shared experience isn't happening anymore. There's shows we like. He uses the example of Yellowstone being a very popular show. And although people can name Kevin Costner, as far as being able to name everyone on that cast, harder to do. There is YouTube stars, Mr. Beast, obviously being the most watched person really on the planet, I believe is the title that he holds. That's one person that maybe someone can name on YouTube, but there's a lot of different people on YouTube that a lot of us follow in different ways. So we're not having that shared experience of watching the same thing at the same time. And he's asking this question, if we don't have that shared experience, then what are we actually sharing when it comes to national culture? And what does that mean for the fabric of society if we're not really sharing those things together? We once did it with the news. Walter Cronkite, you got a broad swath of the American public that would watch Walter Cronkite or Peter Jennings. And now we don't have that in the news anymore. So what does that mean for American culture? He sort of raises that question. He doesn't answer it, but I thought you would find that question really interesting too. And how do we bring back that shared experience when we're all really having different experiences with those that are responsible for telling America's story, which is one of the reasons why Smarter News matters, why nonpartisan news source, a place for you to come and collectively come from a lot of different backgrounds. And you all are so really fascinating. You're from so many different places. You have so many different thoughts and things. And you find a place here. It's one of the things I'm really proud of with Smarter News. So now we just have to get 40 million people on this platform. No big deal. So if you could help me with that, just by spreading the word a little bit, I'd appreciate it. So let's get to the news here. I want to talk to you about these three big stories that really do matter. I want to start off with the U.S. border, because big picture with the U.S. border, we have seen a historic pace of encounters. What does encounters mean? This is when law enforcement encounters an individual who does not have legal status to be in the United States. The picture that may come to mind is someone who is illegally coming across the border. But once they're encountered by law enforcement, that can mean a lot of different things. They could be seeking asylum. They could be a minor that law enforcement takes into custody. They could be removed from this country. They could also be arrested and taken into custody. There's a lot of different paths for someone once they're encountered by law enforcement. So that's why we use that overarching theme or word of encounter. In previous years, we used to use the word apprehension, but that would conjure up this image of arrest. And we knew that a lot of people were not arrested, and that if you were pursuing asylum, you actually fell into a different category. So that's why we use this term, encounter. I want to show you the latest data that we have from Customs and Border Protection, because we're going to hear a whole lot about the border as we get closer to Election Day. And in fact, let me pull this up fuller so you can see it more closely. This is a great resource from Customs and Border Protection. It's going to show us in comparison several different years. So orange is the line for this current year, black is for last year, and so on. And this allows us to compare and contrast different time periods. It's also going to allow us to compare and contrast what's happening at the northern border and the southern border. Again, big picture, if we just look at what's happening nationwide when it comes to border encounters, we've seen more than 2.2 million encounters this year. Right now, that's on pace for the third highest encounters in modern data collection, going back several decades. We still have 4 more months of data collection. So regardless of what happens from this point on, this is still a historic year when it comes to encounters. However, when we look closer into the numbers and we look, for example, at the Southwest land border, which is where a lot of the attention is focused, you can see that there's been a decline in recent months over encounters. So really from March, it was a slight decline, February to March, April, May, we're seeing that number go down. And we don't really have a reason for this, at least to provide at this very moment. What story is behind this? It could be a lot of different things. Are we seeing that decline because of policy changes from the Biden administration or anticipated policy changes from the Biden administration? Are we seeing it because it gets hotter during the summer and that can slow the amount of people that are coming across the border at different times? Weather can be a factor. Are we just seeing fewer people to make this decision at the Southwest border? Do we actually have fewer numbers because we have fewer resources? So Border Patrol is under-resourced, and therefore they're just not encountering as many people. Maybe there's the same amount of people, but they're not encountering as many because they have low resources. So you can see there's a lot of different reasons for this decline. I want you to know that there's a decline though. And because there's many different reasons, and these numbers can be used in different ways by different political parties, different lawmakers, different advocacy groups, I want you to understand that while we see a slight decline, we don't have that one reason for it. Now, I want to show you what's going on at the northern land border, which we've been paying close attention to, because according to the data that we see now, this was the highest month of border encounters at the northern border that we've seen ever in modern data collection. We always had to say modern data collection because we don't have data collection in the same way going back 100 years. We have it basically the same way for the last several decades. This number pales in comparison to the Southwest border. We're talking about 18,000 plus encounters versus 170,000 plus the Southwest. They're not the same, but we're seeing a pace go up at the northern border. So there's a story there too as well. And what is the reason for that? Is Border Patrol just more vigilant at this time? Are we actually seeing more people? Is the northern border something that is now an area for traffickers? One of the former heads of Customs and Border Protection said this is the case. We don't really know though. And again, we can't really compare north and south because the numbers are very different. But I also think this is important for you to know as we take a look nationwide again as to what's happening at the border. So big picture, still a very big story. If we go granularly, there's something in there for everybody. What is this story telling us? We're not quite sure yet. We're going to have to wait a couple more months to see, is this downward trend sustainable? Do we suddenly see a spike? Do we have a reason for what's going on at the Southwest border or the northern border? How does that just get discussed? And we expect this to get more discussed as we get into this intense election period, I would expect that we're going to get a question of some sort on this during the debate this week. I would expect that. We don't know. We have no idea. This is a big story. It's one that we'll continue to watch because it'll be even more relevant as we move closer to Election Day. You can see September is the final date that we're going to get a report card for the border. We're not going to get September's numbers until late October, which places that right before Election Day. A lot of voting will happen in the weeks around that time period, but you never know what could be the news item that motivates voters one way or another. So I thought that was important for you to know. Moving to the big topic of the week when it comes to the highest court in the land. And one of the ways to kind of tie the border to what's going on legally is that we're seeing different policies put forward by the Biden administration unilaterally through executive action that may or may not withstand legal challenge. So that's why we might see some different shifts in what's happening at the border. And we may see a different border story emerging, even from that the White House is trying to tell, depending on what stands and what doesn't survive court challenge. The Supreme Court, though, has several big decisions. We have 14 different decisions that we're expecting this week. And we expect them based on the calendar to come on Wednesday. So we actually have a date for it. Doesn't mean we're not going to get decisions going into July. It's just not very typical. We usually end in June and everybody goes on vacation. Even the Supreme Court justices. I don't know if that's going to be the case this year. I don't know because we have a lot of different decisions. But the big one is about presidential immunity. And one thing I want you to know about this case is although this is incredibly important for the time that we share, it is so much bigger than this one moment. What the Supreme Court decides about presidential immunity and presidential prosecution, the potential for it, could impact the American presidency from now until kingdom come. So this decision will get heavily politicized immediately because we could see the decision applied to the cases potentially that former President Trump faces, but it's not just about him. So don't get totally sucked into that. We have to see how it's going to apply, but we also know that it's going to be bigger than that. So what am I talking about with presidential immunity? Big picture, there's a case in the DC federal court. The Justice Department says that President Trump is guilty of fraud and obstruction related to the 2020 election and events around January 6th. President Trump denies this. And former President Trump's team says, actually, you can't prosecute him because he's protected by presidential immunity, meaning the actions that he takes while president, related to the presidency are protected by law. Sorry, you can't bring that case. The Department of Justice was anticipating this and really wanted the Supreme Court to weigh in. They wanted to get an answer on this quickly because they wanted this case to go to trial. That didn't happen. The speed of the court did not work exactly that way. And so even if we get a decision on this particular issue about whether or not President Trump can be prosecuted by the federal government in this way for actions taken while in office, we may not see a trial. The likelihood right now is that we're not going to see a trial related to this anytime soon. Again, that can change, but that's another reason why we're really looking at this particular case. So I was trying to think of an example for you of like, why is this even a question? Because the president is not a king, and doesn't he fall under the law just like everybody else? Like, he's not allowed just to be a criminal. You know, he can't just go rob a bank and say, well, you know, it's all I'm in office. I had to do it, so I'm protected. That doesn't make any sense. Why is this even a question? One of the reasons why it's a question is because of the nature of the work that the president does. And this feels a little opaque, but you know, think about the conversations related to national security. Think about the conversations that a president is having on a regular basis regarding classified information or the decisions that the president has to make or entertain at different times. What if even during a brainstorm session of how to combat terrorism, you're worried about what you're saying in private because you may be prosecuted by a civil liberties group, for example, at some point? What would that do to the presidency? What would that do to the thinking behind closed doors that is trying to protect the nation? But conversely, what if that thinking isn't protecting the nation? And what happens if it's criminal? So How do you thread the needle? What does that look like? And so that's one of the questions that we're going to be asking when we see the Supreme Court decision on this issue, is how narrow or expansive the ruling is. So can the president be prosecuted in certain ways at certain times, but criminally prosecuted, but not in other times? And what does that look like? And how does the Supreme Court write a decision that can be applied through so many different scenarios? We can't even name them all. So I was trying to think of an example for you, because again, how do we apply this? And I stumbled upon this story. I want to preface this story in that we don't actually know if this took place, but it's been widely talked about. In fact, so much so that the National Park Service took it on recently. And this has to do with former President Grant. President Grant, apparently, in the years following the Civil War, had a little problem with speeding. Speeding, right. There's no cars. Speeding with horses. He likes to race his horses down the streets of Washington, D.C. This was the talk of the town. And in fact, he actually was cited previously, right after the Civil War, for doing this. I believe in Virginia. Let me see if I have that in front of me. But this was something he was known for. So although what I'm about to share with you has never been totally confirmed in Washington, D.C., this happened in Washington, D.C. in 1866. There's evidence that Grant was pulled over for speeding while he was still Lieutenant General of the U.S. Army. So the story goes that after that, that while president, he continued to do this. And there was a former police officer that told this story many years later to a paper. But at the time, it was never publicized. And so the National Park Service is like, if this actually happened, wouldn't we have heard about it? And the likelihood is that we probably would have heard about it. It would have been national news even at that time. So there's a question about whether or not this took place. But according to this account, the officer saw President Grant speeding with his buddies, and it was a problem for public safety. And so he said, listen, you got to cut it out, Mr. President. Enough. The president disobeyed. And then he was cited, ticketed, and arrested. This is the way the story goes. So if we were to take this story and apply presidential immunity, there'd be a question about whether or not President Grant was operating as president when he was arrested. If he was operating as president rather than just a personal hobby, is he protected from criminal prosecution? He has to get somewhere really fast. So that's why he was running to a meeting. So you can't arrest him. Other than he is president of the United States, but this was something he was doing in a personal capacity, and therefore he is open to criminal prosecution. You see how that could work? So I leave you with the story of a speedster president. Whether or not this actually took place, we don't know, but it's a good example. Like, we could take that and apply it to modern day. You know, there's a president and he's speeding down the road. He's on vacation and he's arrested for drunk driving, for something like that. Can he be arrested and criminally prosecuted for that? The president doesn't drive himself, but let's just say for the sake, could he be arrested as a private citizen, even though he's serving as president of the United States? What if he was driving between official events? Then is he protected? You see how this brings up some really interesting questions. So this is why what we're going to watch for the Supreme Court matters, and also why it matters not just for this current case that President Trump faces, but for the presidency in the future. So who knew? President Grant liked to race. He liked speed. Fought for the Union, and then just liked to race down the streets of Washington, D.C., apparently 13th Street specifically. So if you're there and you walk down 13th Street, just think of President Grant. Okay, quick final thing, and then we'll leave it here. I actually have some sound that I want to share with you. And this comes to the issue of presidential debates. So what's going on with presidential debates this year and why it really matters? Presidential debates matter and have mattered for several decades because we actually are able to see the two candidates face off in a live setting. We're able to observe how they not only answer questions, but how they behave. And we know that debates in the past seem to have swayed the public in a variety of different ways. So there's some debate about how much they matter. They certainly can spawn a new cycle of their own, depending on the behavior, the answers, and what takes place. In years past, in most of our lifetimes, the presidential debates were run by a nonpartisan nonprofit, the Commission on Presidential Debates. This organization exists for the reason to help moderate these debates, to be a buffer between the campaigns and the media and the American public. So we have something that is supposed to be independent, that helps choose the moderators from a variety of different news sources, helps produce this event. You get one live feed. All the networks that want to take it can take it, even if that's not their anchor. Let's say an ABC anchor is moderating a debate, but all the major networks are going to take it and everyone's able to see it. This is the way that it's been done in the past. This is how it was done in 2020. And this is how we expected it to be done. In fact, we got a list of where the debates were going to happen. They typically happen at college universities in different key states. We actually expected one not too far from where I'm sitting at Texas State University. There's a big question about, it's still on the schedule. There's a big question about whether it would take place. According to the campaigns, it's not. So what happened is that just over the last several weeks, the Biden campaign said to the Commission on Presidential Debates, we're not doing any of your debates. Sorry. We think you're outdated. We're not doing them. We want to do our own terms. And there's been a lot of theories as to why this took place. And Ryan Lizza, a journalist that's working in part for Politico, he's written large features at The New Yorker. He's a well-known political journalist, actually sat down with the commissioner and co-founder of the Commission on Presidential Debates right after this happened. He had a few theories as to why this took place, the commissioner. He said he thought it was personal, that there was a group within President Biden's camp, long-time political operatives that just don't like the Commission on Presidential Debates. He thought that was the reason. He also thought that there was a concern about a third-party candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., perhaps participating, and the Biden camp, maybe the Trump camp too, didn't want to have that variable perhaps added to the stage. These were all theories that he was putting forward. The Biden camp put forward a letter and was just very clear, this doesn't work for us anymore and it's outdated. And by the way, the schedule doesn't work because there's a lot of early voting. And so we want to do something earlier. And so we're going to arrange our own debate with the Trump campaign and we're going to go through CNN as the first purveyor of this debate. So that's what's actually happening on Thursday. What this looks like and how this debate is going to be run is going to be controlled by CNN. So let me give you a scenario. In the past, Fox News would have taken a debate that the Commission on Presidential Debates was overseeing. Even if there was a CNN moderator, all the networks would take it, even if it was a competitor. In this case, there's a question, well, how is this debate going to be broadcast to different networks? How is the information going to be shared? Are networks going to try to funnel the viewership of this, to control it just to them? Are they going to allow other people to see it? Again, is there going to be a shared experience with the American public? Or in order to have that shared experience, do you have to go to CNN and CNN only and be within their ecosystem? So this is a way that your experience as a voter and an audience member will change because of this very significant change. This is the way that debates have been run by the Commission on Presidential Debates. This goes back to 1988. So we haven't seen anything like this. So as far as what to anticipate, what's it going to be like, we have an idea. We've all seen a debate before, but it is different when it comes to the presidential election. So I thought there were some sound bites from this commissioner, Frank Fahrenkopf, and his observations. Again, he was very raw coming off of this announcement. He still believes that they could have presidential debates that they're going to moderate. We don't know if that could take place. Their debate started in September. The Biden and Trump campaign would have to agree to this. But he was asked a very pointed question about why the Commission on Presidential Debates matters and whether or not maybe the commission is outdated. And I thought you would like to hear what he had to say.
Why should your group, a group of unelected Washington officials, get to decide who the moderators are, when the debates are, where they are? Why should it be you guys through a process that some people would say is not that transparent? And correct me if you think any of the premises are wrong.
Who else would choose them? One of the reasons we were created was that the candidates over 100 were canceled. Who's going to agree? And it was just, so we're down the middle. We're nonpartisan. We're neutral. And we're trying to make decisions on who should be the moderator based not on whether it's going to help my side or the other side, but who's going to do the best job of getting these candidates to tell the American people where they stand on the issues. You know, there's one other part of the debates that I think is very, very important. I've always looked at it as two things happen. If a debate is a good debate, number one, you've informed the American people where the candidates stand on issues that are important to them in their daily lives and so forth. The other was they get a feeling for the people. Who are these candidates? What's their personalities? Do they obey the rules? Are there courtesy? Is there courtesy there? It's very, very important. I've asked a lot of times, Frank, what have you learned after doing 33 debates? Is that the American
33,
people,
that's the number.
33, presidential, vice presidential. What have you learned? I said, I've learned that the American people would really like to like their president. And so I think that they're not only making decisions based upon the answers that are given, but how they handle themselves.
Yeah.
So I think that they're getting a perception on the human being that's up there, as well as learning where that person is and where they stand on the issues.
If you don't get to a 34th debate mm-hmm. and the CPD is gone, mm-hmm. what do you think we will have lost?
Well, I think we'd have lost a lot. I say that because, unfortunately, I am really worried for my grandkids, what kind of country we're going to have. So many traditions, so much respect for other people.
And he went on to talk about some of the relationship that he's had, you know, coming from a certain political perspective and seeing the discourse that can take place through presidential debates that he thinks is important, you know, formulating ideas, putting those ideas out there without the fear. I mean, there's always a fear that the public's not going to like your idea, but that we've entered a stage where even presenting a new idea, the cancel culture associated with that and how that's affecting free speech. I wrote down two things, you know, that he observed the public likes to watch during a debate. Do they follow the rules? Does the potential leader of the free world follow debate rules? What does that actually look like? And also his observation that the American public actually wants to like their president, that we actually really want to like the person. And it's not just about the policy, obviously. It's also about the personality and the behavior. And this is why the debates matter. I'm curious your thoughts on this. The debates in 2020 were challenging. I'm using that as a very generic term. It was a challenging time historically. There was all sorts of different challenges associated with the debates. There was a lot of yelling and arguing, and the behavior was actually one of the big takeaways from the debate rather than the substance. I'm curious how you're approaching this debate now, 4 years later, believe it or not. It's hard to think that 4 years later. What do you really want from this? And do you think that there's something here of value for you, not only for you as a voter, but our shared experience together? Frank shared one more thing, and I'm going to leave you with this. We're going to come back and just talk briefly after it. But I want you to hear his answer to this particular question, because we always ask, why does this matter? You know, why does any of this matter, the news stories that we're covering? It matters because your story matters. And liberty is the pursuit of the story that you want to tell. This is why a free press matters, that we're able to present a lot of different options for you, a lot of different stories of what's happening in the world, why it matters. And then you're able to make some decisions as a free person about what sort of life you want to live and who you want to be part of that life, whether it's government or in your actual community, more closely attached. So I want you to listen to this. I wasn't expecting this. This is the last question of the interview. It's a reminder. You got to listen to the end, even if it's an hour plus. Listen to what he has to say here.
Question on this show is always proposed by our last guest. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you the question from our last guest, who happens to have been Speaker Mike Johnson. Mm-hmm. And then while you're answering that, come up with a question for our next guest, who you don't know who it's mm-hmm. going to be. Mm-hmm. And his question, he said, what makes you proud to be an American?
That's a very good question. That's one of the things I'm concerned about. with the younger generation. I came from nothing. My dad was an automobile mechanic, worked in a gas station. He kidnapped my sister and I when I was 9 years old. And in those days...
Your father kidnapped you and your sister?
Yeah. In those days, you could only get a divorce in one place in the United States. This is 1949. And that was in Nevada. And he and my mom had been not getting along. They eventually got divorced later and went out to Reno. And for the first 6 months, we lived in a bus that didn't have wheels on and with an outside bathroom. And we, you know, started from scratch. I worked my way through through college. I went in the Army. I read at a high school. There was a draft on. I served at Fort Ord in California and then came back to the University of Nevada, Reno. And I worked a couple of places. I worked at the YMCA and then I worked in a post office. I went and collected mail from all the mailboxes and threw it at night and so forth. And my wife, who I've been married to now for 62 years, she came from nothing also. And she worked and put me through law school at the University of California, Berkeley. I was there in the left-wing capital of the world. And then I went back to Reno and I, you know, slowly started. I started as a lawyer at $500 a month.
Wow.
In Reno, Nevada. And then, you know, then I worked and I got involved in politics. And I served my country. And in a way, I've looked at the debate commission and my time and effort in all these years is part of also of my responsibility for my country, because I think having those debates is so important for democracy and freedom. And that's why I do it. And I know this country and I have great confidence in this country. I'm concerned. I just believe in democracy. So I believe in our system and I believe in the future will be great, but I'm just worried about where we are.
I thought that would resonate with a lot of us listening, because what a story, number one. You could tell in how he talks a little bit about UC Berkeley. I'm smiling because I'm from San Francisco. You know, the left-wing comment, he comes from a perspective that's more conservative, but his work in a nonpartisan group is because the group involves a lot of people of different perspectives together trying to produce these debates to make sure that they honor all the different perspectives that are out there, and that one network or one media channel over the other doesn't get a hold on the debates in a way that wouldn't be good for the American public, because that's his priority. You could tell in his voice, you could tell in how he reflected on that question. And I wanted to leave you with that, because that is why it matters. It all matters, not only for us and our story, but the stories of future generations. And so in all of this political haze and debate that we're going to get, the Supreme Court decisions, debate over the border, all of it, it's great to be grounded in this. This matters because America matters. And you matter in telling that story, that next chapter of what this country looks like. And that is the power of the people in America to be a driver in that story, not just a passive consumer. So I look forward to linking arms with you as we go through the next several months and head towards another really important decision about who the leader of the country will be in the White House, but also who will be leaders in the Senate and in the House and a lot of other elections as well. We're going to be really paying close attention to what is the story that we're going to tell. What is that going to look like for us and our families? So we have some breaking news that we expect this week. If and when that breaking news happens, we will be able to respond. We will respond, and I will make sure to share that response with a breakdown of, you know, what kind of the big points of these different events, whether it is the debate or the Supreme Court decision, you know, the bullet points of what to know, why it matters, so you have clarity. So know you can come to us at smarternews.com and throughout our social media channels for that. We may not be the first, because I like to let it simmer for a second. We want to be the most thoughtful and have the best use of your time. Someone can jump on live television and go for 3 hours. I prefer to condense it and go for 3 minutes and leave you with something really good and free you up so you can have more time in your own life. So just know that even if we're a little bit, we might be a little slower than 24-hour news channel. That's on purpose. We actually think we could provide greater value. And I'm curious your questions so we can answer them as these different stories come up. And I feel like this little attention, a little asterisk, because this is what we do expect from the Supreme Court this week, this decision on presidential immunity. We do expect the debate. But until I see it, you know, I'm going to wait to see it to believe it, because we're in that sort of a year where this is where there's some vulnerability. For example, if one media network is doing something and one campaign doesn't like it, what's holding that campaign to continue? There's some questions I have about this. So we're going to wait till the events happen and then we'll move forward on that. I look forward to your questions and comments as always. We'll have more on smarternews.com. And as always, thank you for being a part of Scoop and supporting Smarter News. We have a variety of different ways that you can do that. You can shop in our Smarter Shop. You can leave a tip. There's a tip jar in every little post that we have on our website if it feels good to you. I'm personally annoyed by all the tips that we get in those screen. Like, you feel every single time you feel guilty, right? There's a line behind you. Everyone's watching. You're going to get 15%, 18%, or 20%. You're going to do a custom amount. We all know how that feels, right? So I want you to feel comfortable in how you're supporting us. Just being here and spreading the word about Smarter News is actually the most powerful thing that you can do. So thank you for your support. And we'll see you next time with more of The Scoop, scoop.smarternews.com, smarternews.com for the regular news. And we'll be back with breaking news as it happens, with what's going on and why it matters. Have a great week, you guys. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news. And we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also, that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.